This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, I see you're wearing a very blue shirt today in honor of a very blue drink. Is that your first glass of Romulan ale?
No, Chris. It's just a blue mug on the outside. No Romulan ale. It's as we are recording this, because of our time zone differences, for me, this is my first cup of racked Gino in the morning.
And so I see.
It would be a little early for Romulan ale. So, okay.
So that's like one of those fake wrappers, like when you have the beer can and you have the Pepe label wrapped around it.
So I just have the Romulan ale label on there. So it makes it look like I'm just a raging alcoholic. Right. On Deep Space Nine. So.
That's why it's, for those listening, it's so hard for us to record it because of our time zone difference. It's 7 a.m. for Matthew. It's 11 p.m. for me. So Matthew's having coffee while I'm having sake.
So there you go. Yeah.
Maybe we could reverse that. All right, Matthew. Anyway, today we are going to bring everyone a commentary. And we're going to go with the episode whose title made the Voyager guys ask Ronald D. Moore, "Are you kidding me?" That's right. It is Inter Arma Enum Silent Legis from Season 7, originally known as Untitled Bashir.
That actually would have been a really interesting episode title, Untitled Bashir.
That was the original. That was the working title for this episode. But they decided to go with the Latin. And I think it makes both an interesting and a confusing title for everyone. It is, in fact, one of, I believe, 8 episodes of Star Trek that have Latin titles, 2 of which are from Enterprise. So, you know, they got in the game a little bit late there.
And it's interesting because, you know, I love how Star Trek and the writers, especially when they're really on top of their game, are reminding us of something that's so important to our history. And this is a phrase that will really mean something in this episode and come to expound upon what they are trying to say and ask really this question, this Latin phrase, you know, does the law stand silent in the time of war? And, you know, what a perfect time to ask that with Deep Space Nine and our first seeing war on screen for Star Trek.
Yeah, especially at this point and what's going on in the series and what Admiral Ross is dealing with. But why don't we talk about that as we go along? So everyone, we're going to do a commentary, but those who listen to The Orb know that we talk all the way through the commentary. So if you're listening to this and you're not at home and you're not near your television, you don't need to wait until you're there to listen. You can just listen, take it as a discussion, We'll have the audio underneath softly so you can follow along. If you want to watch together with the episode, that's great as well, and we'll help you cue things up here. But don't be turned off because it's a commentary. Think of it as just yet another discussion on the orb. All right, Matthew. So, I think we're both queued up, right?
Yes.
All right, everyone. So, let's hit play in 3, 2, 1, play.
All right, next item.
I always thought it was interesting, Chris, how this episode has a lot going on in it, and that one of the interesting parts is watching these allies, and I put the kind of in quotes, you know, work together that aren't used to working together, specifically the Klingons, the Romulans, and the Federation. This is not something that any of them are used to, and I really like them kind of dealing with the implied maybe some racism here, like that Kree-Tech actually may imply, like, why are you taking care of the Klingons before us, you know, when our ships are more damaged? Is it just because we're Romulan? I think this is such an interesting thing to deal with, especially here in this war, where, you know, it's thrown these different groups together that we've never seen together, and how would that actually work? And this is, I think, kind of how it would play out. You know, you'd start this petty bickering, but it also it is a very good point to watch them actually try to work through it. And, you know, what a great way to, one, kind of start an episode, but two, what a great thing to kind of tackle, because it's a very Star Trek thing to tackle. You know, how do we actually find a way to work together when we've never worked together before? What does that look like?
Well, I would also say, in the case of Deep Space Nine, what you and I talk about so often on here is the fact that if we reach that utopian future, that vision that Gene Roddenberry had, we will all have to defend that, right? You can't get there and then everything's okay. You always have to be vigilant. And that requires working together. And that's what we're seeing in that scene. I love this scene here with Garak and Bashir, because they always have such wonderful conversations. And the things that Garak in particular has to say here, I think, well, they tie into reality like we're talking about right now.
I'm afraid I can't talk about
that. Yeah, and I like that they're having the conversation about one of his spy missions right before we're about to dive into Bashir being given a mission and false pretenses of being somewhere, but not really going to be there for the right reason. And hey,
funny how that happened, right?
Yeah, Bashir also has that same mug I'm using.
So he's also actually drinking coffee, and he just wants to show off and pretend
absolutely
he has some Romulan
right
there. Showing off for Garak.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, isn't it obvious? This is a golden opportunity.
What I like here, though, is how Garak plays it up. And we think back to Bashir's James Bond holosuite programs and how much he wants to be the private eye. And Garak says this is a golden opportunity to gather intelligence on Romulan intentions and military capabilities.
Well, and it's so interesting because you think about it, and that's exactly what any group would be doing. You know, I mean, yes, you're allies at the moment, but you're also using it to gauge where your enemy will be after the war. And what was so interesting here is how they're tying in a lot of realities from World War II. And the fact that, you know, the United States and Britain, we worked with the Russians, but we were also very wary of the Russians and their intentions after the war. And by the end of the war, it was fairly clear that we should be quite worried about them. And so they're working that in here, and I think it's very smart. And it is interesting to watch Garak, the eternal pessimist, with the eternal optimist of Bashir, who's slowly becoming less and less maybe optimistic all the time.
Yeah.
And and then of course we end up here where you see Section 31 is doing the exact thing that Garak said that the Federation would be doing, which is to spy on this ally.
Don't you think that within the Federation, though, that Sloan has this reputation of being this creepy guy that you wake up and he's sitting at the end of your bed with his hands, his fingers in a temple, shape.
Yeah, it's pretty awkward. I mean, if you wake up that way, Chris, you know you're probably in trouble. But you're absolutely correct in the sense that, like, isn't it pretty much any time he shows up, Bashir's asleep? This guy's a real creeper.
I know, right? That's what I'm saying, right? You're sleeping and he shows up. You know, while the credits are going here, just rolling back, I said that the things that Garrick was saying to Bashir tie into real life as well. And the main line that I was thinking about is towards the end of their conversation when he says, "I live in hope that one day you'll come to see this universe for what it truly is, rather than what you'd wish it to be." And when I hear that line, I feel like that really sums up Deep Space Nine, at least in comparison to The Next Generation. Mm-hmm. Because The Next Generation represents Gene's vision of this perfect future where all the problems have been solved, whereas Deep Space Nine represents the fact that you have to fight for paradise. You might achieve it, but it can be taken away from you in an instant if you're not vigilant. Mm-hmm. And you know, the world, even in the 24th century, as we see it in Star Trek, it's not that ideal vision. It's different than what you'd wish it to be, as Garrick is saying. And I think that's a really good message.
It's something that I've always loved. You know, you were teasing me the other day, yesterday, on iMessage, the Orb of Steel.
I was thinking of that on how
I really enjoy that whole idea of kind of seeing the way people become icons, you know, like either comic book characters or, but in Deep Space Nine, it is so much about how the Federation maintains and balances and works towards utopia, that it's not just we achieved it and now we're done. And that's one of the things I have to shout out to Enterprise. I always loved that Enterprise was talking about how did we get there? You know, what is the process to which we got there? Not just for humanity, but even for the Vulcans. And a lot of people didn't like that. And I think, you know, Deep Space Nine tackled that subject, opened that door to allow that to happen. And we get amazing stories like this that deal with the realities of that just because it is this quote-unquote utopia, not everybody's going to figure out how to do that, right? Like, or want to do that the same way. And Section 31 definitely has its own ideas about how you keep utopia, and that's that there's going to always have to be a group that has to keep its hands dirty for that to happen while the rest of people live in relative, you know, peace and ease. And I can't say that they're completely all wrong when we look at the history of the world.
Well, that's what I was thinking, right? Unfortunately, that's probably true.
I say that because when the war is over, the following will happen.
So Sloan is here. Sloan is convinced that Bashir really wants to know what the mission is, that Bashir loves mystery and he's going to be sucked into this. And the genesis of this episode actually goes back to the season before, sixth season, Inquisition, the 18th episode. So it's almost the same point in the season where Sloan comes to the station. And as is mentioned here in the episode, Admiral Fujisaki dies of food poisoning at a critical moment. And after that, Sisko encourages Bashir that if Sloan ever comes back, you know, you should play along like you're interested in what's going on so we can find out more. And that's exactly where we are at this point.
Personal, fictional.
And I love, too, that they're having this whole conversation and Bashir says, "This war's not even over. You're already planning the next one." And it's so interesting because in the end, that's how you stay ahead as a power, is thinking ahead of those around you. And I think the goal here, though, and what I think is so interesting, is it doesn't seem to be Section 31's goal to start another war. Their idea is that they want to make sure that they can position themselves beyond the Romulans and maybe create a sense where there isn't going to be a war, you know, because what he's really saying is there's probably going to be almost this cold war that happens between the Federation and the Romulans, and we want to make sure that we come out ahead of that.
Yeah. There's already a cold war happening pretty much.
Absolutely. Yeah.
While you were talking about that, Matthew, I don't know if you noticed, but your 6 seconds of Ezri happened.
Yes,
she's only in this episode for 6 seconds.
Well, and Bashir ran into her in the hallway in his pajamas. That's a little embarrassing.
Very convenient, Julian. Mm-hmm. Yes, very convenient. But yeah, what you're saying is absolutely right. And I mean, that's a little bit of that Star Trek element that I was talking about with TNG. Bashir seems put off by the fact that Section 31 would already be planning for the next war. But in reality, you have to plan, right? If you're only looking at this conflict and you're not anticipating what might happen down the road, you're always going to be caught flat-footed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what they say will happen is absolutely what happens. Cardassia becomes a non-factor. The Klingons, because of the way Gowron fought the war at the beginning, spend the next 10 years having to recuperate. And that leaves only two major powers in the or at least the Alpha Quadrant, Beta Quadrant area of the galaxy, and that is the Romulans and the Federation. And both of them are poised to be on the brink of maybe even expanding because of this, you know, after this Bajor might enter the Federation, you know, we could have maybe a new peace between these two, or it could turn into something like a Cold War or an all-out war if they're not careful, and how you handle that transition is going to be massively important. And so that seems to be what Section 31 is planning for. And maybe the way that they're going about it isn't the best way here, as we'll see throughout the episode. But the actual idea and intention to know those around you is excellent. So, and I have to call out Chris.
It's a Voyager episode.
Class vessel. And I absolutely love this about this episode because, you know, anytime you watched the original Star Trek, you know, you would see other Constitution class vessels. It wasn't weird, right? But by the time you got to TNG, you stopped seeing vessels like the Enterprise. It's like they thought people would, you know, not know what it was, but here you use an Intrepid class vessel, and I'm not like thrown off that it's not Voyager. And I actually like it. I just think it's really smart that, you know, well, obviously they're just using the sets on Voyager because they're there. But the reality that you have other vessels of the same class throughout the galaxy was just a lot of fun. And it was actually kind of fun to see Deep Space Nine crew on a Voyager set and they're lighting for the Voyager set. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting.
As an exhortation, never to give up.
I'm a little bit mixed as far as them using the Intrepid class on here because I don't know. It catches me off guard a little bit because I know that Voyager's happening at the same time. And I understand from a creative standpoint that they can save a lot of money. I understand the point that I think Ronald D. Moore made that it would be nice to use a bigger ship, not a Defiant-class ship. And I agree with that. If you're going to go to Romulus, yeah, you're going to send something else. But at this point in Star Trek, you'd send the Enterprise, wouldn't you? I would think.
Yeah, unless the Enterprise is on a ship of that size, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe even a galaxy-class starship.
Well, right. In due time. The thing is that they're using stock footage here, and it feels like stock footage. And at one point, if you look closely, you can see 74656 on the hull of the ship, which is Voyager's registry number. And then there's another shot where they've changed the registry number.
The Department of Cartography, he's been a low-level bureaucrat for almost
so, I don't know. It doesn't bother me, really, but I'm kind of mixed. But seeing the sets, yeah, that's kind of interesting. Like, right now we're in here where we've got Ross and Bashir talking, where we would normally see Janeway talking to someone.
It's also kind of fun just to see the Deep Space Nine uniforms at this point on Voyager. Mm-hmm. You know, because obviously they don't have those. And right. I really, really enjoy these uniforms. These are some of my favorite of all time in Star Trek. They look great, I got to say. I have to point out, the lighting here is different than it is on Voyager. And it's really, really well done.
Now praetor of the Romulan Star Empire.
And now we put that genetically engineered mind to use for Bashir as Sloan quizzes him about all of these different Romulan ambassadors and
senators.
Senators, yeah. Yes, yes. And trying to make sure that he has it all down. Yeah. Gotta love the fact that he can remember all this stuff, you know, just off the top of his head because, you know, he is genetically engineered.
Yeah, I want to see Julian Bashir as a contestant on Space Jeopardy. Because I think it would be the ultimate showdown, like Deep Blue versus Julian Bashir. Yeah.
Starfleet intelligence doesn't just die of food poisoning.
That would be pretty awesome, actually. I think they probably have a rule against genetically engineered people being on, you know, Space Jeopardy for that very reason.
Maybe Space Jeopardy, but if he were to time travel back to today, I don't think any such rule exists, Matthew.
That's true. That's very true. So, good luck on him. I think he'd get it. So
I noticed one thing here. As we know, on Vulcan, they have pets called Salites. And apparently on Romulus, they have pets called Setleths, which is an awfully similar sounding word. And when you look at how language drifts over time, especially when a language becomes isolated elsewhere and you give it a few centuries to evolve, the way that words evolve and transform makes me wonder if this might actually be the same animal, at least originally the same animal, and the word in the Romulan language, which came from Vulcan, changed a bit.
Our physicians weren't genetically enhanced.
Yeah, I absolutely love the way that they play with the fact that they are an offshoot of the same, you know, species. And I also really like this idea of Bashir trying to figure out what his actual goal for being there is. Like, what does it really want me to do? And he thinks he may have cracked it when they're talking about this Senator Kovar and the fact that he may have an illness that might hurt his chances of being on this very important Romulan committee that Section 31 feels will actually be beneficial to the Federation if he is, and that he's here to diagnose him. And I think that's a really interesting idea, and specifically putting his genetically enhanced abilities to use, because he may be able to pick up on things that maybe just a normal doctor wouldn't be able to.
I'll spare you the ends justify the means speech, and you spare me the we must do what's right speech. You and I are not going to see eye to eye on this subject, so I suggest
you discuss it. I'll spare you the ends justify the means speech. You spare me we do what's right speech. I love that. This isn't like Sloan's telling him, look, I get where you're coming from. You know where I'm coming from. We're not going to agree, but we have to work together, and we could actually help each other. So
yeah,
let's just focus on that, okay?
So they talked about, you know, in the writing of this, how they wanted you to feel along the way as you're talking about that Bashir has it figured out and that Bashir is in control, but then we find out that actually Sloan is in control.
Which is a nice twist that by the end, when he realizes that he's been played by everyone, it works so very well. And it's classic for Bashir because I think he's one of the few characters it is hard to pull the wool over his eyes because he's genetically engineered at this point and because he's become so suspicious of everyone. Mm-hmm. But it still shows he has much to learn about the spy game that, you know, he just hasn't been able to get himself in completely to that mindset yet. And I think it's just a great episode for the character and kind of the evolution of the character, which I really like. So,
do you know how to introduce the quickening into a population?
I love the scene that we're on right now where Bashir says, it's a pleasure to meet you. And Koval says, why? And Bashir says, well, you've got me there.
<It's> just, yes.
So honest. It's just a simple form of expression, I suppose.
Much less someone wearing that uniform. Starfleet intelligence should recruit.
What's also interesting, too, and I really like about this episode and the way that Deep Space Nine brought in the Romulans is we got an opportunity to really explore the Romulans more than just the, like, mustache-twirling type villains, you know, that we did on on TNG, and this gave them, I think, a lot more life. And the Romulans, unfortunately, have never been treated well by Star Trek, but they're a fascinating race. And I would have loved to have seen more continued in them, and if they had been done better in Nemesis, it might have helped. But this really, I think, brings to light this interesting race that I would have just liked to have gotten more in. Yeah. And this conversation, like here, that Bashir is having with this Romulan senator there, it's just full of wonderful, like, nuance to it and texture, because it's Romulans and they don't necessarily always say what they mean, and you're trying to figure out what's going on. It's great stuff.
Well, they're very devious. You know, the Klingons are, their society is in reality complex, but what we mostly saw in TNG is they're very two-dimensional. You know, they're very aggressive. Mm-hmm. They're kind of Viking-like, kind of samurai-like, whereas the Romulans, especially as they're portrayed in the modern series, TNG Forward, you know, they flip places. We talked about before in the original series, the Klingons were the Russians and the Romulans were the Chinese, but it kind of flipped in the modern series, whereas the Romulans become the Russians, become the Soviets. And it would make for much more intriguing. If you wanted to do a Star Trek series that was really filled with political intrigue, then you would want to have the Federation with an organization like Section 31, and you would want to have the Romulans as the primary foe that they're facing off against.
Now answer my question.
Well, and it's so interesting, too, because, you know, they bring something back from, I think it's the fourth season of Deep Space Nine with the quickening, and that's the whole presentation that Bashir's giving, and obviously that the head of the Tal Shiar, Koval, is interested in that, and this whole idea of biogenic weapons, and I just kind of love that they pulled something from Bashir's past and from the show, so you're like, oh yeah, I remember that episode, and all it took for Bashir to figure that out, you know? And I just think it's one of those things that Deep Space Nine does so well as they craft episodes is, you know, they're very aware of where they've been where they can pull on those threads.
Never mind.
Exactly.
Thank you, Doctor. You've been very helpful.
So now Bashir starts to figure out that, well, maybe he's not there to diagnose and help, but instead, Section 31 might be looking for a way to accelerate this illness.
Yes, yes. And at this moment, I love that he is able to go to Ross to have these conversations and to talk. And it's one of those things, like, I love Ross. I've always loved that character in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Not specifically where they went with him in the books, but it's such a great... He's an admiral we could finally get behind, like that we could understand that he's not a bad admiral 24/7. Like, he really actually is a good admiral. We see the weight of the decisions that an admiral might have to make in Starfleet, and specifically during war. And I just, it's something that's it's a pleasure to be able to watch, because before this, we've never had an admiral we even ever wanted to care about at this point.
Well, Matthew, you remember last summer, the last episode of The Orb that we recorded before my eye surgery saga began was when Jenner passed away, and we called it the Good Moral.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe Sloan has an accomplice here on Romulus.
Also here, this is the first time, and it's actually the only time on television Star Trek that we see these white dress uniforms that Starfleet has that were introduced in Insurrection. Second.
Yeah, and they're not my favorite Star Trek uniforms, but I think they, I don't know, maybe it's because they make them look like waiters at a really fancy cocktail restaurant.
Now I'm remembering the old Saturday Night Live sketch when Patrick Stewart was on and they did Love Boat, The Next Generation, and they had the white jackets and the shorts.
Yes, yeah. Just make those pants shorts that Bashir has on right now, and
yeah, get some Bermuda shorts going on. Yeah.
Well, and this is another really interesting thing too, that they're in this conundrum, like how Ross says here. How do I explain Section 31 to the Romulans? Like, how do I explain how we are figuring this stuff out? they've really been put in that rock and hard place, you know, because Starfleet would never want to admit to a power like the Romulans that, we have our own Tal Shiar, basically.
Mm-hmm. But the Romulans must know.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But, I mean, it's that place where Ross, as an admiral of Starfleet, could never admit that openly to the Romulans, even though the Romulans probably already know.
I'm sure they know, yeah.
Found him slumped over his desk.
Do they have any idea what happened?
Dr. Frank.
And then the worst happens, and we take Ross out of the loop by giving him a quote-unquote aneurysm.
We take him out. Sloan takes him out.
Yeah.
At least that's the implication. I love here when Bashir is walking out of the mess hall and Sloan just raises his glass to him. It's like, hey, doctor, how you doing? With that look like, I got Ross out of the way.
Yeah, it's that. You got played, sucka.
Yep.
Yeah, he's such a good actor for Sloan. Like, it just really perfect casting. So, and I also have to say, I really like this matte painting they use for Romulus. Looks really good.
Which we then get fleshed out at the beginning of Nemesis.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
No one else to turn to. I need your help.
To do what?
So, and what's really cool here is the way in which Bashir reaches out to this senator.
Caval has been saying
that he feels like he can trust and on Romulus. And I thought this is what makes for such a fascinating episode and all the nuances that go into this kind of political machinations.
Mm-hmm.
Bashir finding a way to trust a Romulan. And, you know, what's great about it is it makes you feel like, could there be a new beginning for Romulus and the Federation if they could do this, if they could find a way to trust each other.
Personal database.
Right.
It stands to reason that it contains...
Well, this coupled with what we see in Nemesis with Donata, for example, shows how the Romulans are, I think, reasonable people, like individual Romulans, are much more reasonable than, say, Klingons. Senator.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And
they're more
and
like
also,
humans. We can't
trust each other. And I think it shows that they have that side of them that where the Vulcans come from, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that makes for a much more interesting. There you go, NCC 74656.
Yeah, there it is. So,
yeah, that's nice.
What's Voyager doing around Romulus?
It got home for about 3 weeks and then got lost again. Way to go, Kathy.
No, they found their way home and they said, wait a minute, this is Romulus. Let's go back.
Most of my knowledge on Tuvan syndrome comes from studies done on Vulcan patients.
I thought Vulcans and Romulans were virtually identical.
Yes.
Yeah, see, there's Sloan just assuming that Vulcans and Romulans, they're the same thing. They're interchangeable.
Well, and I think that's something that's fascinating when you think about that, you know, Romulans and Vulcans diverging so many, you know, like a millennia ago, if not longer. And you put them on different planets, and so their genetic structure begins to change to fit their environment that they're in, and so they aren't going to be exactly the same. You know, they're going to have some similarities, but their environments have helped shape them into slightly different versions. So you can't just assume that they are one for one. And I think that's a fun thing that it's just one of those things you wish you could get more of. Because it really is a fascinating thing. So I'm just appreciative that Deep Space Nine touching on all these little issues.
What a pleasure to see you again.
Which over that time frame, of course, they're going to still be mostly the same, but like you said, there are going to be some differences that start to creep in, which, you know, could play a factor, especially when you're dealing with medical topics.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I would like to have a word with you on another matter in private. Of course.
This is a point in the episode where I feel like maybe it's just me, but you have to watch it a few times before you really connect the dots as to what has happened here. Why he's suddenly pulling Bashir in and asking him, who are you working for? And then you realize, well, okay, so Bashir just had the conversation with the senator, and now kind of the cat's out of the bag that there's something going on. Whereas maybe the first time through, you just feel like, well, maybe the Romulans are just a little bit wise to what's going on, and they've decided that, you know, mm-hmm. Koval's decided that Bashir looks suspicious, because you can think of someone who's in a spy organization, they're going to be able to read people quite well, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But in reality, it's because Bashir reached out.
This can be painful or not. That's up to you, Doctor.
I love that, you know, it's John Fleck playing the Romulan here, you know, mm-hmm. and he'll play Silic later on. And he's played so many characters in Star Trek. But it makes a perfect Romulan. Like, yeah. You know, and a very kind of creepy one. So, very good job.
It appears that your brain's neurocellular structure is not susceptible to us.
You're like, dang it, we can't use our mind shifter probes because, well, your brain isn't normal for a human, so...
A great deal of trouble if you would simply tell me what I want to know.
You haven't asked me any questions yet.
I think you know what I'm interested in. Who are you working for? Why are you here?
I like this, too, because it's the complexity of the spy game here that is kind of frustrating Bashir. Like, he's finding all of these different nuances that he just wasn't expecting. And all of these different factions and sides and you know, people working with different people and not necessarily knowing that right in. And he really is thrown in the deep end here. And he kind of doesn't know what he's playing at just yet.
I think that's kind of natural, right? When you're looking at the enemy like that, you kind of see them as being a monolith, and you don't think that there's that complexity there, even though you know on your own side there's that complexity. So, of course, there's going to be complexity within the ranks of a government anywhere, and with an enemy, especially someone like the Romulans, who are so scheming. But nevertheless, even someone like Bashir, like you're saying, I think it's true. He probably wasn't expecting to walk into all of this internal intrigue that's going on.
Well, and this is the major moment where, you know, Bashir just takes the leap. I'm going to tell the truth of at least what I know to be the truth of what's happening. And I'm hoping that the Romulans will respect that I'm doing so, and that we can find a way to work together, you know. And I really think that it's a powerful moment for Star Trek is he just admits that, yeah, there's a Section 31. They're trying to kill this, you know, the Koval. I reached out to this Romulan Center Kree-Tech for help, and I'm trying to avoid an assassination here. Like, I'm working to undermine what they're trying to do.
I asked the senator to obtain the database so that we could expose this person and prevent the assassination.
This scene, the fact that there is a Federation, a Starfleet officer sitting in this chair, admitting all this to the Romulans, is surprising and powerful for sure. And the fact that on this council, we do have someone who is a Federation operative, someone who's working together with Starfleet.
Yes, yeah.
If I may be permitted to bring in another witness, bring in prisoner 527.
This part is quite odd. Now, tell me what's going on here.
Praetor, this is the...
Well, this is the point of the episode where they bring in Sloane.
Is it Sloane?
Yeah, you don't know.
There is no Section 31. Sloane, in fact, works for Starfleet Intelligence.
This is where they just kind of start blowing your mind. Like, wait, what the heck?
I mean, I've been trying to figure out, so if they didn't shoot him at the end and vaporize him, then I'm thinking, well, okay, so this is Sloane, but He's Sloan did not take the death of his maybe well. Neral has arranged for him. Neral is the politician on the council who's actually working together with the Federation, because if you go back to unification, you know, he talked with Spock.
How could he seek vengeance without violating
through Pardak? And so that's how he's involved. And you're thinking, well, maybe Neral has set all of this up and they've made it look like Sloan has been beaten and tortured when he really hasn't. And it's all part of a plan to say, well, there is no Section 31. And that way, Neral is able to keep his seat on the council and continue his work with Starfleet Intelligence, you know, which I think is what's going on. But now, whether Koval here is in on that, I don't know. If you listen to what Koval says, you're like, maybe Bashir was trying to kill me. Maybe he was trying to save me. We'll never know. I'm just really suspicious. It almost comes off to me at the end like it was all a big game to get rid of the Senator Kreetak.
Yeah. I think that you're right. I think that it is all to get rid of Kreetak, and that it is Koval being played and he doesn't realize it, because he thinks all the information that Section 31 is allowed to be leaked about this makes it feel like, yeah, there is no Section 31. It's just Sloan. We've connected it to the past, so it all makes sense. It all looks basically above board for the spy game.
Yeah.
And so I think it's one of those things where you kind of realize just how powerful and devious Section 31 really is. Like, that Sloan is a lot more dangerous, and the machinations that are happening here are so much bigger than just what we think of as this small little organization. They really are this power throughout the galaxy that is having some major influence that maybe we didn't even realize until now. I mean, we've already known Section 31's bad, right? But this is a level of influence that I don't even know if till this point we had expected.
But we know Sloan's not dead. He comes back later to start later in the final season. And at the end of this episode, even Ross
admits, he's not quite dead.
He's not dead. Yeah, I'm not dead yet.
So, shut up, you'll be done in a minute.
But this man is vaporized. So is that a weapon that's transporting him somewhere?
Yeah, and
is he really being vaporized?
That's what they say, if I remember correctly, in the next time he's on, is that he was beamed away the moment. So,
which is what when you watch it, you think he's being vaporized. But then if you really think about what's going on and you know he comes back, then you assume, it must be some kind of weapon that transports him somewhere. Mm-hmm. But if all you're going by is what you're seeing on the screen at the end of this episode, there's a lot to take in there, and there are a lot of pieces to try to figure out how they fit together.
Feeling better, sir?
Much.
I absolutely love this moment where we have the showdown between Bashir and Ross, and this is the moment where we see that there are things which Ross and the Federation are willing to accept about Section 31 when it is really to the Federation's benefit. That, you know, you and I even love that, you know, they take their communicator off and like this is off the record.
This is off the record. See, if I want to resign, I'll take my pips off. If I want to talk off the record, I'll take my communicator off.
Which does that mean that when you remove your communicator, is there like a recording function in there? Like,
that's what I was thinking, right?
Yeah.
Probably. It's probably recording everything that you say. It's probably like the Echo. It's like they incorporated Amazon technology into the communicator badges.
Wow. Federation Big Brother. Oh, that is creepy.
Creepy, but it wouldn't surprise me if that's actually the way those things work, right?
No, absolutely. Well, I mean, how do you think we get all those, like, you know, audio and video recordings on a ship? They're everywhere. I mean, even your cabin quarters, it seems like.
Aneurysm, leaving me alone with no one to turn.
So what do you think about the end of this episode?
And as I realized your involvement,
it turns out that, you know, Bashir is lecturing Ross. It's kind of like the way Picard was lecturing Daugherty in Insurrection.
He was supposed to be beamed away a split second before the phaser beam hit him.
Although Bashir's kind of, it goes on a bit longer than Picard's. But it isn't really the way that the story was supposed to end, at least according to Ira Stephen Bear. Ira said that he was disappointed in this because he wanted to do a show about compromising Bashir. But in the end, Bashir winds up lecturing Ross. And so Bashir, as Ira said, Bashir gets to walk away clean, and he's the one pointing the finger. And he said that in his opinion, and this is in the Deep Space Nine Companion, he says that it takes the show down a notch and keeps it from reaching the level that we wanted. I mean, do you agree?
Well, and I think, as you're saying that, I'm immediately thinking of, remember statistical probabilities where Bashir is willing to have the Federation surrender. Because
right.
He thinks it's the best thing to do. So I think that the Bashir here would be somebody who would be able to see the light of compromising his ideas and ideals for the greater good. I think Bashir's that kind of guy. And I think, Ira Stephen Bear has a real point here that you lose a way to add nuance to a character and to this whole thing by just allow him to be the one who moralizes at the end instead of being the one who compromises in the end. And basically what it would have been interesting is that he would have become more like Garak. Like, by the end of the show, Bashir would be more like Garak, and Garak would be more like Bashir, so that they'd kind of be more meeting in the middle. I think that would have been really fascinating.
You trampled on the very thing that those young men and women are out there dying to protect! Does that not mean anything to you?
Enter Arma, Einem Sealant Legis.
So Ira draws a parallel within The Pale Moonlight. He said that at the end, Bashir winds up making this angry, pointed speech to Ross, which is a lot less interesting than the situation at the end of In the Pale Moonlight. There, a man is trying to deal with his own culpability. And this is a show that demanded, I felt, Bashir's culpability. And he gets to walk away clean. However,
you're dismissed.
Do you think it's completely a parallel between what Sisko did in the Pale Moonlight and what Bashir did here? Or do you see a parallel between Sisko in the Pale Moonlight and Ross here? Because Ross is really the one making the decisions to do this. Bashir is carrying it out. He's the one that actually goes down to the Senate. But Admiral Ross is the one who's in command. And he's the one who I feel is really torn up inside over the choices that he's having to make.
Are you expecting applause?
I absolutely agree. I think that it's interesting to watch Ross be that character. And I think it seems like what Ira wanted was that it was both maybe Ross and Bashir who are that character.
Or just Bashir. But
or
maybe
just
both.
Bashir.
But primarily Bashir.
But I do think that it does make it interesting. And maybe this is the reason that that Sisko and Ross work so well together, is that in the end, they do have the same ideas about what is important and what is needed to save the Federation, and that sometimes in war, bad things do have to happen to protect the Federation.
Share your sense of right.
And so I think that to me is really fascinating. And I think it's also interesting, of course, we learn here that, Sloane is not dead. And, you know, for him, he and Section 31 do see this is that they are protecting the Federation. And their goal is not to, it doesn't seem to be, at least from what we learn here in the show, I'm not talking specifically about the books at all. But what we learn from the show is that they aren't intervening all the time. They only intervene when they feel that it's absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there is a strategical, surgical nature to Section 31. And I think I to me, it makes them more than just the mustache twirling bad guy. There's a lot more nuance to that, and I think that's really fascinating, actually. And it makes them a much better quote unquote villain than just somebody who's always doing the bad thing, the wrong thing. You know, like it's classic Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Well, plus they're a villain from the inside, right? They are us. They're not an outside force mm-hmm. that we're fighting against. They are people within the Federation who feel strongly that they're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. I guess the difference is, and I mean, I'm sure like in any organization, there's going to be a few bad seeds, right? But mm-hmm. for the most part, I think Section 31 operatives, they believe that what they're doing is to protect the Federation and to protect Federation citizens and to save the society that they love and that everyone cares about. They're not doing these things to be evil in their minds. You know, we might look at what they do and say, hey, that's terrible.
Yep.
But that's not what's driving them, which is different than, especially when you look at science fiction where you've got aliens coming at you and you can just kind of turn a blind eye to them and just see them as this monolithic evil force, right? It's not like that. It's coming from inside.
Well, and I think it makes it so much more interesting, you know, because we have to deal with the reality of the situation, you know, and that's really what Section 31 and I think Deep Space Nine is all about is, and what rightly pointed out that Garrick says at the beginning, we have to deal with what the universe is, not just what we want it to be. Mm-hmm. And when we only see what we want things to be, well, then we're missing everything. It's not a bad thing to want the world that we live in to be different, but we also have to realize the world we're in so that we know what changes would need to be made to make it better. If we only live in a fantasy world, one of our own creation, where we can just be whatever we want to be and we're lost, you know, we might as well live in a holodeck, but we're here, we're grounded, we need to see what is, so we know what needs to be changed to make it different. And I feel like it's such a great thing that Deep Space Nine does. And it's something that's so exciting to me, you know, to watch its legacy live on. Because every time that we talk about it, every time we watch one of these episodes, Chris, I'm just reminded of the job that they did and the ways in which Deep Space Nine continually is relevant to whatever we seem to be in. And it's a masterful job for the writers, and it's mm-hmm. what makes this show stand out above all other Star Trek for me. And I'm really excited because you know, they got the Deep Space Nine documentary that they're working on, and I can't wait to see that and see those reflections for the writers and the cast.
Yeah, that's going to be something.
Yeah, it really is going to be something, Chris. But I think the show is one of those, it just deserves that, you know? Like, it deserves to be talked about. It deserves to be watched. Mm-hmm. It deserves to be thought through. And it deserves
to continue deserves to be remastered relevant. And put on Blu-ray, Matthew.
Absolutely. But, I mean, you could just even sell it to me on streaming. You don't have to give me discs. Just sell it to me. You know, I could download it. I would buy every single season on my iTunes. Because you're absolutely right. Even just thinking about this show, this episode, the lighting on the Bellerophon is beautiful. And it's a completely different lighting scheme than what they did on Voyager. Mm-hmm. Same sets. Yeah, same sets. And so, excellent work and a fantastic episode. One of Deep Space Nine's, I think, most challenging. You know, even if the end wasn't exactly what Ira wanted, it's still a very challenging episode.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the end, so the episode ended a few minutes ago, and the thing that Sloan said to Bashir at the very end, I just want to mention, and then we'll go into our closing here. Bashir, you know, he wakes up again, and there's creepy Sloan at the end of the bed, as we talked about earlier. And Sloan says, good evening. And Bashir says, are you expecting applause? Have you come to take a bow? And Sloan explains to Bashir that they chose him for being a decent human being. That's why we selected you in the first place, we needed somebody who wanted to play the game, but who would only go so far. When the time came, you stood your ground, you did the right thing, you reached out to an enemy, you told her the truth, you tried to stop a murder. The Federation needs men like you, men of conscience, men of principle, men who can sleep at night. And then the key thing, you're also the reason Section 31 exists. Someone has to protect men like you from a universe that doesn't share your sense of right and wrong. And that's, you know, we see that in our own world today, especially people who think very progressively and you feel like the world's moving forward and you feel like the wrongs of the past are behind us, but they're not. And they rear their heads, and you have to be aware of that. And as Sloan is saying here, you know, there have to be some people to look out for those who don't realize that the universe, the world, it doesn't always share our sense of right and wrong, and bad things can happen.
And I think, you know, that's something that's really important in a world specifically that, you know, we live in today, where there's no universal standard that we look to for right and wrong. We live in a really gray world, and when you don't have that, you have a much harder time when people don't agree about what even maybe is right and wrong. And so it makes it much more difficult. And Sloan's point is very wise. You know, if you live in that universe, it's much more difficult to discern what to do and how to do it, because not everybody agrees with you. And in the Star Trek universe, it's Idic, right? And so, yeah, nobody has to agree with everybody. We just did whatever, you know. So it's a messy, wonderful episode, and it reminds us how difficult it is to live together, and that it's never easy. And it's fantastic, Chris. It's just so fantastic.
The last point I'll make, Matthew, about the end of the episode, because Ira compared this to In the Pale Moonlight. When you look at the strength of the episode, when you look at the strength of the message and what the situation and the events that the character found themselves in meant to the character, when you look at what Sisko said at the end of In the Pale Moonlight, it's one of the most powerful moments in Star Trek, I think. And Sisko says, "A guilty conscience is a small price to pay for the safety of the Alpha Quadrant, so I will learn to live with it, because I can live with it. I can live with it." And then he tells the computer, "Erase that entire personal log." Whereas at the end of this episode, Bashir calls Odo, Bashir to security, Odo answers, "Odo here," and Bashir just says, "Never mind, my mistake." Mm-hmm. So the message is sort of the same, like they've both been through this and they're going to deal with it themselves. But Sisko's situation is extremely powerful, where I feel like this episode, for all the greatness of the message of this episode, does end with a little bit of a whimper at the end.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think they could have done a bit more. But nevertheless, I think it's one of the great Star Trek episodes, one of the great Deep Space Nine episodes. One thing I wanted to mention, Matthew, before we close out here, are a couple of contrasting viewpoints on this episode. So Star Trek Monthly, that magazine, when this episode came out, they gave it 4 out of 5 stars. They loved it, and what they wrote about it was that Inter Arma Enim Silent Legis is by far one of the best episodes the series has produced in its 7 years, turning every concept on its head and providing the most intriguing and controversial story to date. I'm not sure if it's the most controversial story, but it's one of. I'll give them that. They went on and they said, "As the mysterious and self-righteous Sloan, William Sadler is the perfect foil for Dr. Bashir's idealism, his parting words, and example of Ronald D. Moore at his finest. This is the dirty world of covert operations at its thrilling best." What do you think about that?
I don't know if it's the most challenging, because I think In the Pale Moonlight is probably
that's what I was thinking of too.
The most challenging, but I do think that they've made an excellent point about the episode, and I think it is absolutely a the perfect foil for Bashir and that optimism that he has. And it's
yeah, and idealism, as they said, which is exactly what is coming through very often mm-hmm. with Bashir.
Well, and it's the same thing, and it's really the extension of what's been happening to Bashir this whole time with the relationship with Garrick, you know, and that's why they have that relationship played out at the beginning of the episode, and you can see the ways in which this life on Deep Space Nine, you know, Bashir was the guy who went there to be on the edge of frontier medicine, but it also meant being on the edge of the frontier. The final frontier of what it meant to be the Federation in the wilderness. And Bashir's finding that the wilderness is a lot more challenging and a lot more gray than he ever expected. And that's changed him from the beginning to end of the show. And I think we've talked about all of the characters here on this show before, Chris, and I think it's one of the things that's really beautiful is the ways in which the arcs for these characters really progress. And I think Bashir has one of the best arcs in the show, along with somebody like Kira, where he goes from being this wet behind the ears, obnoxious, you know, person to being somebody who's been tempered, you know, very much so by the experiences that he's had. And what he's learned, and he's become a little bit more pessimistic, he's become a little bit more worldly, and he's become a little bit more thoughtful in how he views the universe. And I think this is one of those episodes that really showcases the difference that Bashir has, and the difference that the frontier, the wilderness, has made on Bashir in his life.
Listening to you talk there, Matthew, reminds me of one of my favorite scenes, actually. Do you remember the scene when, not in this episode, but elsewhere in Deep Space Nine, when Sarek was talking to Bashir and he asked him, "What have you done out there on the edge of Federation space?"
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
All right. So the other thing I want to get your thoughts on. Now, this comes from our friend Keith DeCandido, who, of course, has been with us on Literary Treks many times. And if you remember, Keith was doing that rewatch, DS9 rewatch, on tour. And I respect his point of view. I mean, he's a very accomplished writer. I don't completely agree with him, though. He mentioned that he was disappointed with Barry Jenner playing Ross, and he described his performance as wooden in this episode. And so when I was watching it today, I was watching and I was thinking, okay, so Keith says that Jenner's playing Ross very wooden. But I didn't really feel that way. I felt that Jenner was, for the most part, successfully conveying someone who was very unhappy with the decisions that he was having to make, and he was very torn up inside, and he felt very down about it. And so I think the performance is very low-key, which could come across as wooden, but I feel like Jenner was doing that as a way of showing the internal conflict. Did you feel that way, or did you feel like Keith did, that maybe it was a bit wooden and there wasn't enough energy behind it?
When I watch the episode, what I see is a man that is unhappy with the position he's been placed in.
Yeah.
And that's how I see it. I've always liked Barry Jenner. I thought he was always fantastic in the role. I don't really know how else you would play this one to be unwooden. I don't see that at all, honestly.
I think maybe. Maybe this is what Keith was looking for. When I'm watching it, I can see where maybe Ross could be a little bit more passionate. Mm-hmm. Like, especially at the end when Bashir is getting very passionate in his lecture to Ross. Maybe throughout, Ross could be a little bit stronger and more passionate about the positions and the actions that they have to take. But then again, I think if he did that, it might say that he felt confident and he felt justified in doing these things, and maybe he did feel justified, but I don't think he wanted to make these decisions.
Yeah, because specifically in the last conversation, I feel as though, you know, he puts his badge back on and he says, "This conversation is over. This conversation never happened." It feels like somebody who's saying words but doesn't really want to be saying them. And right. and therefore, maybe that comes off as wooden, but I think it just comes off as a guy who's very unhappy about the position that he's been placed in and the decisions that he feels he's had to make. And therefore, he might be expounding the view, but it's not a view he's really excited about, you know? Yeah. And therefore, you're not going to be giving that as passionately as you would what Bashir is giving back. He's just yeah. spouting off the things you have to say when you make that kind of decision. But it's I don't think that that's who, at the core, Admiral Ross is. You know, that's not who he wants to be. He just feels like he has to be that yeah. to make that decision. And therefore, I think it's actually perfectly played. So I would heartily disagree.
I also think that the performance was consistent with how Ross is portrayed throughout the final arc, in particular where he has a large part in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't think it was very unusual or out of place
right,
for what I would
right.
expect from Ross. So anyway, that just caught my eye that that's what Keith had said about it. But yeah, but otherwise, that's the episode. So everyone, I hope you enjoyed our commentary where we talked over most of the scenes and sometimes ignored what was happening on the screen. That's why I told you at the beginning, just listen to it like a normal episode of The Orb and don't worry about if you're at home with the TV running or not. But we would love to hear your thoughts on Inter Arma Enum Silent Legis. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Probably the best place is in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right on up. It is a closed group, so if you're not a member, you'll need to request to join, but we'll let you right on in. We just want to make sure that we're just getting listeners in there because it's a place for us to extend the conversations from the show, and we do a good job of keeping those respectful in there, so we want to keep the riffraff out a little bit. And also, you can send us an email if you'd like. If you go to trek.fm/contact and use the form there, choose to send to a show and choose The Orb, and that'll come to both Matthew and me by email. You can also find us on Twitter, where our username is TrekFM, and you can find our brand page on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Now, Matthew, when you're not trying to infiltrate the Romulan Senate, where can people find you?
Oh, goodness. Well, when I'm not trying to do that, which it's taking up all of my time these days, Chris, you can find me covertly tweeting from Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me on Instagram, maybe taking some secret pictures at MRushing.
Oh, wow.
I'm here on the network.
Wondering what those are now.
I don't know.
Matthew, this is why in Japan, by law, the iPhone has to make a noise when you press the shutter button.
Oh, goodness. So you can also find me on the 602 Club talking about everything geeky that we love that isn't revolving around Star Trek. There's so many fandoms that we love. So I hope you'll join us over there. We have a really great time. Revolving group of hosts talking about anything and everything that we can fit into that show. You can also find me on the Nerd Party Network doing aggressive negotiations with John Mills all about Star Wars and, of course, about Harry Potter, doing Owlpost with Drea Kaufman as we walk through each and every chapter of that series. And last but not least, I have a new podcast. I know that's crazy, Chris, but it's called Cinema Stories.
Matthew.
I know,
wow.
A new one since the last time I recorded. And
you're like
that just,
me circa 2012, 2013.
Pretty much. But that one is all about film through the lens of faith. And you can find any of those shows on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And Chris, when you're not pretending to have an aneurysm so that you don't have to go to work that day, where can we find you?
Yeah. I know Sloan conveniently gives me a day off from time to time. You can find me elsewhere on the network doing The Ready Room, where we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series, and actually 6, because Larry Nemechek and I have been doing a number of shows about Discovery recently. So you can find me there. You can also find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com, and that's pretty much all I have going on at the moment in terms of media involving Star Trek. But you can find me on Twitter, where my username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can also find me on Facebook at that username. That's my username pretty much everywhere. And you'll find me there in the Babel Conference. Now, Matthew, we should also tell people that Deep Space Nine, I mean, we love to talk about Deep Space Nine, and Larry actually on the most recent Ready Room pointed out to me that I seem to have a thing for Deep Space Nine. And I told him, well, you know, I do that show called
The Orb. That's shocking, Chris.
I know, it's very shocking. But The Orb in DS9 isn't the only thing that we talk about here on Trek FM. So here's a quick look at some of our other shows.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
Of all the things people to wonder about and question and be concerned about canon and visual canon on Discovery, the Klingons haven't concerned me that much because I think the Klingons are ripe and long overdue for, you know, for lack of a better term, some species diversity. And one of the things that Star Trek is prey to, and people acknowledge it, but still, we wish it wasn't a limiting factor, was TV budgets.
To the journey!
But imagine how much his big black eyes would have popped if he was wearing the blue face paint.
That is true.
Like a bullion. I didn't realize the bullions were Scottish, but you know.
Bullions could be Scottish.
Warp 5.
I just thought, you know, those are where, of course, some of the other Enterprise references come up. He was a Mako. He fought in those Indian Romulan Wars. I really like that background and that tie-in. And it makes sense that, you know, over the course of 100 years, that somebody's going to kind of go a little crazy and, you know, get to this point where they're just, you know, seething for some kind of revenge or something.
The 602 Club.
That emotional core. And I tie that too with the mentors that Peter doesn't have throughout the film. There's nobody there to pick up that Uncle Ben slack.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts, iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Spreaker. You can find The Ready Room on Spotify and iHeartRadio. We're working on getting all of our shows onto iHeartRadio. And you can also find us in various third-party apps, or you can go to our website and stream or download the MP3 files. So we have you covered whatever platform you use. It's very easy to find all of our shows. You can also get the Trek FM Master Feed, which includes every episode of everything that we do. And while you're there in iTunes, if you're an Apple user, be sure to leave us a star rating and a written review. We'd love to hear your thoughts on our shows, and that also helps people find us because it helps boost us up a bit in the search rankings. I also, because I made my little Sarek joke there towards the end of our discussion today, I want to remind everyone that we have a new podcast on the network, The Edge, which is our Star Trek Discovery podcast, and that's hosted by Amy Nelson, Mike Schindler, Aaron Harvey, and Brandon Shea Mutella. As well as lots of guests, we're going to have all sorts of people on there. And speaking of Larry, he's on episode 2 talking about Sarek and Harry Mudd and how they might be used on Discovery. So be sure to check out The Edge. We're going to be keeping you informed every single week up to the launch of the new Star Trek series. And that's the latest addition to the network. Also, Matthew, we want to thank our associate producers here on The Orb, William Murray and Kay Elizabeth Shaw. Thank you so much, William and Kay, for helping us keep The Orb going. If you want to catch Kay, you can find her over on our Voyager podcast, since Voyager made an appearance in this episode of DS9. That's To the Journey, which I yelled in the middle of the show today. You can find Kay over there with Suzanne and Zachary talking about Voyager every week. If you'd like to become an associate producer or just help us keep all of our shows going and become an associate producer on another Trek FM show, you can do that by supporting us through Patreon. We do need your support to keep everything going here on the network. It costs quite a lot of money, and we are listener supported. And you can find out all about that by going to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. Find out everything you need to know over there. We have lots of perks for you. Patrons Roundtable, special website, all kinds of things. So please check it out, patreon.com/trekfm. All right, Matthew, well, that's everything here at the end of the show. I've really got to get back to my Section 31 training. I don't know if you know, but they chose me because apparently I'm a nice guy.
Wow, Chris, that's awesome.
That's what Sloan told me.
Well, best of luck with that, and hopefully you live long enough. And we want to thank everyone for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb. Recording. Bashir's spy pants.
Levi's buttonfly section 31 pants.
Wow. Yeah.
It sounds like, you know, they give their pants a number, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It's like 501 jeans. It's like mm-hmm. yep. 301 jeans. Sloan yep. wears buttonfly 301s.
301s.
The O is silent.
The O is silent. Oh man. We didn't have to. It's just 31. We didn't have to continue with all those other numbers. We got it right at 31. So,
you know, that reminds me. I'm a little bit worried now whenever I go into Baskin Robbins. You know, 31 flavors.
Ooh. It's a covert operation.
It is a covert operation. Yeah,
they all want to know what your favorite, you know, they all want to know what your favorite flavor is. So the moment they know that, it's all over.
Well, I also think that it's quite odd when they ask me what my Setlath's name is.
Yeah, I never answer that one. Nor do I answer what my favorite stuffed animal was as a child. So,
yeah, you don't want that to get into your Section 31 Starfleet Intelligence dossier.
Yeah, Kukulaka is just for me.
Oh, you let it out. You're like George Costanza with Bosco.
I'm out.
All right. So, okay. So before we don't hit play yet on this, right? We've got to do our introductions.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Okay. Here we go.